Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Been a while since we aired part one of Saving Baby Joseph, so here's an excerpt from the part one interview leading up to this interview, which is to help you better understand the danger the baby's been put in and the medical means of implementing those dangers. Our guest, Sam Sansalone.
I thought I ought to get a channel opened up, a channel of communication opened up to the family in case they were wanting me to intervene in any way.
Okay.
What I had at my disposal. So this person became quite excited at the prospect, and said basically yes, that they were gonna pursue making a connection, but they didn't want to get the mother's hopes up so high because she was really suffering.
All right.
And didn't want to bring her hopes up only for them to come down.
Okay.
So as the day developed, they found out more about me. I didn't actually even have time to tell them much, but I told them, you know, if you Google my name, you'll probably find out what I do and how I've been able to help. So I presume that's what they did, because it wasn't long before I was getting communication back where they were very eager to get my assistance.
Oh, good.
So what I did at that point, after I contacted the family more directly, within about 28 hours or so, 28, 29 hours of first getting that call in my sleep-deprived state that Friday morning, I basically convinced the family to not trust this lawyer, to get rid of him,
wow,
find another lawyer, and I had them agree in principle to a plan I had developed. And my plan that I developed was, rather than struggle here, they were having such a struggle here trying to persuade the hospital. I knew enough at that point, by that time, about the kid's background to know that he had visited a hospital in the U.S. in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So I told them, why don't we just pursue getting him to get a second opinion in the U.S.,
mm-hmm,
where we're more isolated from this Ontario healthcare system that is really going to be a stumbling block for you no matter where you go, because throughout what I try to teach this family is it's not the London hospital on its own that you have to be concerned about. It'll be the Ministry of Health, which is Ontario-wide.
Right.
It's, these kinds of decisions that affect these kinds of children come from, you know, a systemic implementation.
Okay.
That is, you can't just point to the hospital. And you can't expect to go to another Ontario hospital and get a truly objective, independent second opinion. So within a day or so of less than a day, I not only did I convince them to get rid of this lawyer and find another one, but I also came up with this simple strategy: just take the kid to the U.S. And since he's already been to Detroit, I explained to the family this gives them certain rights at that hospital. To bring him back. He's already a patient.
Okay.
He's already got physicians there.
All right.
And the reason why, you know, this fortuitous situation existed is because the family lived in Windsor, and they are literally only, I think it's 8 minutes to the U.S., to the Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit.
Okay.
Which is much closer than any Canadian pediatric facility for them.
And there isn't one in Windsor, eh?
No.
Okay.
Not a pediatric facility.
All right.
There's not a children's hospital in Windsor.
Okay.
And they're probably probably won't need to be because there's an arrangement that's made with the Ontario Ministry of Health that allows Windsor area pediatric patients, their families, can take their children over the border.
Oh, good.
To get services there, and it'll be covered by OHIP.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a probably pretty neat arrangement, actually.
All right.
So this was my initial strategy with the family. Get rid of the lawyer.
Yeah.
Let's find someone who will do a proper job, hopefully, and fast. And at the same time, let me try to get you into the U.S. Let me try to get Joseph into the U.S. instead of struggling here. Why struggle here? I said, why? Why? You know, I didn't understand. There was no need. He's already got a hospital opportunity there, and they didn't realize that. Hadn't thought that there was that opportunity.
So this was the beginning of parting of the ways with the Ontario medical system.
As far as, you know, from my involvement, yeah, but they were already well parted long before I came there.
All right.
I think the Ontario, when I examine the history and, you know, my explication of how this developed would have it that the parting of ways happened in November.
Right.
You know, well before any of us knew about
it. So what
anything.
Happened in November?
The child was admitted. Well, I should just tell you one more thing before we go on to that subject. Within one day of that event where I got the families...
On side.
You know, basically, yeah, they came on side with my plan to get him to a U.S. hospital. Within one day of that, I'm not exaggerating, I'm pretty sure it was that Sunday. Yeah, it was that Sunday night. I had in writing a commitment from the U.S. hospital that they were going to accept Joseph. So a lot of to-do has been made about finding Joseph a hospital, but actually it was done within that would have been 55 hours or so of me first getting involved.
Okay.
And then the reason why it became so much of an issue after that is because within 3 days of that, the U.S. hospital came under pressure. And I don't know how much of that I can tell you publicly here, but they came under pressure to rescind their
offer?
Agreement.
Oh.
Yeah, and that there will be a point in time where I can be more open about this, but I'm pretty appalled by how that happened. I can tell you that. And I will tell you this much, that I know from inside sources that the decision to squash that first opportunity that was given for Joseph to go to a U.S. hospital came not from the normal channel level. It came from a very high executive level in the hospital.
Okay.
And I have evidence that it wasn't just the Detroit hospital that was involved in that. So to give you a more sort of an encapsulation of what I said in a more meaningful way, the decision to accept Joseph occurred within just two or three days of my getting involved, and it was done by the proper channels at the doctor and departmental level in Michigan. It was done by the usual medical level, doctor level means. The decision 3 days after that to boot him out and not give him the opportunity did not come from that level. It came from an executive level, at a very high executive level. In the Michigan hospital, and the Michigan hospital was highly, highly influenced, if not pressured, to go in this direction by their partners in the Ontario medical system in Canada. Okay. And they are partnered. They are partnered in a number of ways, and not the least of which is what I just described earlier. There is an arrangement between this Detroit Children's Hospital and the Ontario Ministry of Health in Canada. There is an arrangement where Ontario sends business their way.
Yeah.
And Ontario gives that hospital lots of money to take care of Canadian children who are just minutes away over the border.
Right.
And I'm pretty appalled by how this was squashed. Then the next, you know, 2 or 3 weeks was a matter of foiling Ontario Ministry of Health's further efforts to prevent us from getting into another hospital. So we had to foil their plans to foil ours, and we foiled them in the end.
Okay.
After they got us a few times, I'll tell you. But we learned each time.
Yeah.
Each time they disrupted or tobacco one of our U.S. hostile opportunities by the most disgusting means I could have imagined. Untruthfulness, backdoor channel communications, the complete misrepresentation of both Joseph's case and also the nature of his family.
All right.
These hospitals were being led to believe that this was a family that would be very difficult to work with, that
right.
they can expect. So basically, they described the parents as the kinds of parents who you can expect. If you take this kid in the U.S. in your hospital, expect to get a lawsuit from this family.
Right, yeah.
That was happening behind our backs.
Right.
I have information that I acquired from sources that we
okay.
were able to, you know, verify this information. And it's not just one source. And it's not just one state.
Okay.
We were able to, you know, I got verification. I was able to verify this. Several different states, different physicians involved, different departments, and it was the same story happening over and over again. It was just appalling. I am literally disgusted with how the Ontario hospital system and healthcare system abused their access to communicating with U.S. hospitals. In a most unprofessional and untruthful manner to try to foil every opportunity we developed to get him into a U.S. hospital after that Detroit one. But, you know, like I said, we learned each time, and I figured out a set of principles I was going to use for who the hospital I was holding at the top of my list.
All right.
Because I kept getting referrals to hospitals. Some of them, you know, were meaningfully referred. There was a specific person, a specific department, or a specific experience with this hospital. And then a lot of them were just, you know, members of the public saying, I think this is a great hospital.
Okay.
Which, you know, that wasn't necessarily too helpful because there are thousands of hospitals in the U.S. that
All right.
fit that description. We have, what we need to do is we needed to find in a way that was going to bypass all this media mess that
okay.
we were dealing with, and all the backroom unlawful discussions that were happening between the Ontario hospital system and the U.S. ones that were misleading the U.S. hospitals.
And now on to part two of Saving Baby Joseph with Sam Sansalone.
Sam, we had discussed what you had done since you were called in on the Baby Joseph case, but you were called in, what was it, 5 months into the progress of since Baby Joseph's birth, was it?
It was October that they got into the hospital, towards the end of October in the London hospital, in November, December, January. It was about four months, because I didn't get involved until February, I think it was the 18th or so. Whatever that Friday was in February, in the middle of February.
And you referred to a parting of ways with the parents that you're not sure the parents were aware of, but the hospital was probably aware of when they insisted on describing the child as in a vegetative state, and the parents kept objecting to this.
Yeah, and that is one area of contention that I understand happened very early on.
Okay.
The parents never saw their child as in a vegetative state of some sort.
Okay.
Is what the hospital was saying from early on, and the parents never accepted that because they were getting response from the child in many different ways. And indeed, the child himself was pulling the tube out, from what we understand.
Okay.
The endotracheal tube. So right. How does a person in a vegetative state pull out their tube over and over again so many times? You can see it in one of the videos.
Really?
That's one aspect of what the parting of the ways would have manifested as. Another way is that, and again, the parents might not have been aware of all that was going on, but when a child is intubated, baby's intubated, after about 1 to 4 weeks, the baby is moved off of the endotracheal tube and into getting a tracheostomy so that he's breathing properly and easily, and testing whether the ventilator is really needed, because you don't want to keep someone on a ventilator longer than they need to, or you could actually reduce their chances of ever coming off of it.
All right.
So I have had this reviewed, and one expert in the U.S. said really the trach should have been done last year.
Okay.
It was done in March. type tubes that go through the neck. It allows the child to breathe easier. It allows the child to not look like they're hooked up to all the machinery. Mm-hmm. But one thing we've noted in these advocacy cases is that the hospitals appear to want to make the baby look like they're a hopeless case.
Incapacitated,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and that they're machine dependent, and they want to dramatize this. So they leave a tube sticking out of the person's mouth or out of their neck with tape all over their faces to hold the tubes in place and the big ventilator machine nearby, whereas if you do the trach, all of a sudden the face is clear. The person looks more human again instead of mechanized, and the parents will be less convinced, you know, that this is a hopeless case.
Okay. All right.
And we've seen enough of a pattern of this that those of us in the advocacy community are convinced that this is done as a ploy, as a dramatic effect to convince the parents, and in this case the public, that it's a terrible, a worse situation than it really is. When we go in for surgery and they put us under, we get generally intubated.
I didn't know that.
With an endotracheal tube.
All right.
Yeah, that's what keeps us going, and we're on a ventilator during the surgery while they've got us, you know, all passed out and everything shut down. So the ventilator's breathing for us. So in intubation with an endotracheal tube is meant as a temporary measure.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's meant as only a temporary measure is because it's also dangerous if it stays in longer than just a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And the danger is that because of the damage you cause to the throat,
mm-hmm.
You could actually create a blockage. When you pull the tube out, the throat can collapse in on itself.
Okay.
For example, among other things, there's tracheal edema, which could also set in. There's a secretion management issues that can set in if you leave the tube in too long. There are at least three, you know, major areas of complications if you leave it in too long. So you want that tube out of there within 1 to 4 weeks generally. And certainly you'd have to have some bizarrely unusual reason to keep it in longer.
Okay.
And you want to replace that with a trach. And the trach is much different for the patient as well, not just in terms of safety, but in the comfort aspect.
Yeah, you described
the approximate
straw. Yeah, through your straw in your nose.
Right.
Okay.
In his case, yeah. And you can actually try that. Just try covering your mouth, plugging one side of your nostrils, like push your finger on the outside of your nose on one side so you've only got one nostril. Close your mouth and then pinch that some more on the open nostril. Pinch it a little bit so there's less air going through, and then breathe like that for 5 months. That's what they did to Joseph.
Okay.
That's what they did to this kid. And he was initiating most of the breaths on his own. We know that from the machine data. The problem is when you hook someone up to a ventilator like that, because of the way the pressures occur, and when negative pressure or something to that effect occurs, the machine will kick in where it might not have otherwise been necessary. And that assistance that the ventilator is giving is also causing potentially a problem if the patient didn't need it. We know Joseph didn't need it because he's off a ventilator now. He was successfully weaned from it. But to have left him on not just an endotracheal tube, but also a ventilator for all that time.
Gotcha.
Weakened his chest muscles that are used in breathing. So it made it less likely he would even come off the ventilator. So it's all part of this whole scenario I described where we've seen this repeatedly in cases of cognitively disabled babies, that it looks like they're intentionally hooking up machinery and leaving it in place longer than it's necessary, if it's necessary at all, just to create this drama of, you know, what a horrible, tragic situation, and the best thing is to let this baby go because he's turning into a machine, partly anyway.
Okay.
That's the background of what was happening before I got involved. And the family wanted a trach. Before the time I got involved, the family's focus was give Joseph a trach so that way he can go home.
All right.
And if he's going to die, he can die at home. And that's
loved,
completely valid.
And cared for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. In a natural home environment without all kinds of non-family conducive environmental factors. That when you're in a hospital for weeks, I've done it before. It does not feel like a natural situation. It's not comfortable. It's not just inconvenient. It's massively inconvenient to a family, especially if they have other children. It's very disruptive. It adds stress where stress doesn't need to be there if the patient can be home. So they had a very valid reason for wanting a trach, not just for the medically indicated reasons, because you have to get rid of the endotracheal tube, but also because they want to get him home so he can spend his final days or weeks or months or years in his natural state of family and home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a perfectly valid reason itself, but there was another reason why, because of what I described earlier about the medical sequelae that result from leaving the tube in too long. You create those three risks.
Okay.
Rapidly, you very seriously escalate those. The risk of subglottic stenosis.
What's that?
So the subglottic means below the glottis.
Right.
The stenosis means narrowing.
Okay.
And that will happen. That's the collapsing that I told you about. When you pull a tube out that's been there too long,
mm-hmm.
There's tracheal erosion. Like it literally erodes the inside of the trachea and could damage the structure, the structural
okay.
elements. Normally it's a tube that holds itself open.
All right.
The trachea is a tube that's a natural tube in our body that remains naturally open under its own structure.
Right.
But if you stick a tube down there and you leave it there for months like you're not supposed to, you're increasing the chances of this condition called subglottic stenosis, which means when you pull that tube out, the trachea will literally collapse on itself and the person will strangle.
Okay.
Get strangled from the inside. You won't see it, but it works the same way as if
right.
someone's squeezing your neck with
okay.
their hands.
All right.
So that's one. Two is tracheal edema, which is just swelling of the trachea, massive amounts of swelling from the irritation of a tube. It's not natural for a tube to be down there, so
yeah.
the body reacts to it.
Right.
And one of the ways it reacts in many cases is to develop tracheal edema. So the swelling creates kind of this pressure against the tube, and then as soon as you pull the tube out, all that swelling kind of moves in on itself, and that also closes the throat. So there's
okay.
two, the second way.
Okay.
You could die from leaving the tube, the endotracheal tube, in for too long. And then the third way is another natural reaction of the body to having a tube unnaturally stuck down there is the buildup of secretions, and so much so that it can actually block your breathing. You get smothered by your own secretions, saliva.
Okay.
That buildup there is not just the saliva, but all the secretions from the wound or the tracheal erosion or whatever else is going on. So there's those three ways. There are other things that can go wrong as well, but those are three ways, all of which could lead to death when you pull that tube out if the tube was left in for too long.
Okay.
The family didn't really understand these things. So when I came on board in mid-February, I explained this to them and told them that what it amounted to is basically a way of ensuring that the baby's going to be strangled when the tube comes out because they left it in for too long.
All right.
It almost guarantees that the baby's going to strangle, but you'd never know it. And I explained it that way to them. It's just like as if you had your hands around Joseph's throat. If someone put their hands around Joseph's throat and squeezed to prevent him from breathing, that's how the subglottic stenosis or the excessive tracheal edema would affect his breathing the same way. And what they would do, and I explained this, they would use morphine or fentanyl or some other narcotic or similar, type of thing that would basically knock the kid out. So that...
He can't even fight this.
Well, not only could he not fight it, because it does depress the respiratory drive when you're having that kind of medication come in at high doses. And that is a way of killing them faster when they're about to be strangled by this, subglottic stenosis or the tracheal edema or the buildup of secretions. But it also, dulls the mind. So this is the way I describe it. It's pretty macabre, but I think this is completely a valid analogy. It's like getting someone drunk and then strangling them with your hands.
Okay.
It's really no different. The narcotics are used to make the person drunk, so to speak.
Compliant.
So they don't feel it. And then the perpetrator strangles the drunk victim.
Okay.
this point in the interview, we'll take a break with Duke Robillard. Hard way.
I've had a hard, hard way to go. I've been down and out when the ground was covered with snow. I used to get so weary, I would cry the whole night through. I used to get so weary, I would cry the whole night through. Thinking about my troubles and the hardships I've been through. It's a hard, hard way to go.
You're listening to Sam Sansalone talk about the inside scoop on the Baby Joseph story, the many ways there are to kill a helpless, disabled infant.
And, you know, when I'm talking to parents, I always try to make sure they understand the truth, because everything has to be based on truth when you're dealing with advocacy, as I see it. Everything has to be based on truth, and you just have to take away this veil of trickery or deceit that is used to, you know, convince parents that it's a hopeless case and the public, and make, you know, false statements to the public, which was done by people in the healthcare side of things. One of my chief roles is to bring truth into the equation, both about what the hospital's doing and also what, you know, the patient would be facing. And that's what it amounted to. What they were proposing for Joseph, in reality, in truth, it amounted to strangling him and getting him drunk on morphine and probably using the morphine at such a high dose it would also depress his respiratory drive and make sure it finishes him off. That would have been his likely end had, you know, we not begun the unique interventions that we applied starting in mid-February.
Okay. What was the process of the interventions? I understood the press was pressured not to support you while you struggled to get Joseph out of the hospital.
We do have definite evidence of that, and particularly in Canada, the Canadian press.
Right.
Why don't I give you a couple of examples?
Okay.
One of the things that happened was I called for some assistance in getting some public support. And one of the ideas that came back was to get some prominent pro-life community individuals to hold a press release in London. And there was a disagreement among those who were assisting the family as to whether this would be a good thing. The family by then had decided that I was going to lead the way out for Joseph, and they gave me decision-making authority as well as all sorts of other authority. So the lawyers were reporting to me, anyone else who was involved in assisting or wanted to assist, they were supposed to go through me, and they just placed all that in my hands. So I had to make the decision, and I decided we were getting a little bit overwhelmed at some points with the different things that we sensed were in development that could end Joseph's life sooner.
Right.
So one of the strategies I use in that kind of situation is you create a lot of public awareness, and then you use that audience to, again, bring truth into the picture and expose the truth so clearly that if the child were to die in the next, you know, few days, it would become very suspicious. Because
so it's almost a day-by-day approach that you're taking then.
Absolutely. Joseph's life was saved one or two days at a time, generally.
Really?
Maybe a few days at a time. Yeah, absolutely. And I won't get into all my techniques that I use.
No, please don't, because they're a manual for the people you oppose.
Yeah, I mean, by now they've figured out some of the stuff I do anyway, but I don't think they know everything.
Okay.
But certainly, the basic process is this. I have to gain information about what's going on at the hospital. Then I have to take that information and figure out what they're trying to do to end this baby's life sooner. Mm-hmm. And if the information isn't clear enough, then we have to take our best guess at how they're going to be trying to end this baby's life in the next few days. And I consult with medical experts on this. So I acquire information, sometimes through very surreptitious means, interpret that to understand what they're doing, and then we make counter strategies to counter those efforts that we believe are happening. Either we know directly from direct information that are happening, or we've surmised it reasonably from the best available information. And then you address it over and over and over again. And I can tell you that a lot of people wondered what the heck I was doing when I spoke publicly or disclosed certain things or described certain things. Every single time I opened my mouth publicly, whether it was verbal or in writing, every single time the strategy or the overall tactic anyway was being very carefully considered. And it was with the intent of making sure Joseph is alive for at least the next day or two.
Okay.
And then you reevaluate, you acquire more information. If you can, you reevaluate and you decide what to do. And some of this is played out publicly.
Well, while you're going through this process of prolonging Joseph's life by a period of a day or two, you're also searching for a lever, aren't you, to get him out of the hospital and somewhere where they'll perform the tracheotomy.
Yeah, and that was the really huge challenge here, because there were two fronts, two intense fronts. There were really two battles going on at once, and although they were interconnected. And first, let me clear up a misconception. It was a breeze to get a hospital to agree to take Joseph in for a second opinion. What most people don't seem to be aware of is that within about 36 hours or so of my first making contact with the family, I had in writing a commitment from a U.S. hospital to take him. A lot of people don't seem to realize that. That part shouldn't have been difficult. It was made to look difficult, and it was made very difficult through other reasons. Mm-hmm. As I would have said then a couple weeks ago to you, as well as I've said to others, within, I think, 3 days of that written commitment, we had the opposite written statement from the same hospital. And did I explain that it had come down from very high executive level?
Yeah.
I do remember. I did explain that to you as well.
Yeah, there's money at play here against Joseph's life.
Well, not so much the money that was involved in saving Joseph or preserving his life taking care of him if he survived, because by then what they were spending every day just to keep him in the hospital there instead of letting him have the trach and go home, like that was quite a lot of money.
All right.
And what they were spending on legal fees, I'm sure they must have spent at least 10 or 20,000 pretty quickly.
All right.
Very, very quickly, legal fees. Well, $20,000 for sure must have been very quickly within, I would think, within a...
$20,000 doesn't get you much court time.
No, there was, this was nothing to do with court yet, but it was just to get the ball rolling.
Okay.
I can't imagine that they spent much less than 10 or 20 on, you know, retainer type level.
Okay.
Just to get going. Then the public relations resources they would have brought in,
mm-hmm.
Because it's not just, you know, writing the media releases they were very wrongly making, but it was, you know, the whole process of that involves a lot of conferring at different levels of the organization with the PR people. So they were spending a lot of money
mm-hmm.
that was directed the sole purpose of making sure this baby does not leave their control alive.
All right.
That's very clearly what they were aiming for. They did not want this baby to leave their control alive. And I can't get into all the reasons why we know they were tampering with the U.S. hospitals.
Okay.
But that'll have to wait for a future period when certain things are resolved. But it's that in itself is an incredible story. And it really disgusts me.
Okay. Well, you made clear the mechanism when you talked the last time was that the enormous business that the Ontario government does with American hospitals near the border, and they use that as a club.
Well, and that would help explain what happened in Detroit with that first hospital opportunity.
Right.
But I'm talking way beyond that. I'm talking weeks of things that were done behind the scenes by the Ministry of Health.
Oh.
Long-term care, and not just at the London Health Sciences Center facility.
Okay.
I'm talking over a broader area of Ontario, encompassing a wider range of people in the Ministry of Health system.
You were looking for a Canadian hospital at this point?
No. They were affecting the interpretation of hospitals over the border.
Okay.
Like you wouldn't believe. They were blitzing their communications across the United States.
All right.
And in ways that are very illegal.
All right.
Deceiving the hospitals. There is a lot of that going on. It was a phenomenal amount and reaching very vast areas.
Okay.
And a lot of people who were in positions of decision-making authority.
Okay.
In a vast number of United States hospitals.
Okay.
And it was very clear from there. And I have this as evidence from different sources, multiple sources.
All right.
And what's very clear is that there were two things the hospital in London and the Ontario Ministry of Health were trying to deceive the U.S. hospitals about. One of them was Joseph's clinical status.
All right.
They made it look much worse than it really is.
Mm-hmm.
To try to discourage a hospital from taking him for that reason.
Yeah.
They made it sound like a hopeless case. You know, we've since obviously seen that.
Right.
It wasn't true. He was able to go home on a trach without a ventilator. So that was one area in which they were very deceitful with the United States hospitals and personnel about. And then the other areas regarding the family. They actually deceived hospitals into believing that the family was combative. That was one of the words, actually, that was used, apparently.
Right.
Combative, and that any hospital that very difficult to work with, and that any hospital, they made it sound like any hospital that dares to take this child can expect lawsuits from the family. That's
okay.
The way they described the situation. So they made the child's medical case look hopeless, and the family case looked threatening in
okay.
a legal sense.
All right.
And it really worked. It's okay. Incredible what had happened with several opportunities that were well underway, and the carpet got pulled out from underneath through this very means.
Okay.
And as I said, I'm not just guessing this. We have multiple sources now of evidence.
Okay.
And now, if you could use a break, I'm sure I could. Jimmy Thackeray. Last Night.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Sam Sansalone talk about the inside scoop on the Baby Joseph story, the many ways there are to kill a helpless disabled infant.
So how did you counter this?
Well, each time we had a failure, looked carefully at why the hospitals were changing their mind. I tried to get what information I can. Some of them would become very quiet all of a sudden, wouldn't be forthcoming with any information. But I was able to get some information, and we'd apply that knowledge to later attempts. But I had an ace that I was holding for a while. And it wasn't too long that I had to hold it. But about less than 2 weeks before Joseph made it to the U.S., one of the hospital ideas that was presented to me was for this Cardinal Glennon Children's Health Center in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay.
And the reason why it was, first of all, I'll tell you who mentioned it. They want to remain anonymous, this family, but it's a physician family in the United States.
Right.
And the physician's wife came up with this idea for Cardinal Glennon.
All right.
And her reasoning was that they are, as far as we know, the one last true Catholic hospital in the United States. The other Catholic hospitals in the United States are, they're Catholic in name, but they've since been bought out by, you know, business concerns that are not Catholic. Now, I'm not touting any religion or anything here, and it had nothing to do with any religious decision. What that meant to me was that we have a separation of, just sort of like a separate school system. You have a group of doctors and clinicians that are that have a kind of, they're kind of insulated, both ethically and to a degree, network-wise, from the mainstream, the usual hospital channels.
All right. Funding and bureaucracy and...
Well, everything. So there's less chance of getting... There's less chance of the Ministry of Health getting to that hospital.
Oh, okay.
Leading them than other hospitals.
Okay.
And then, of course, there is the so-called religious aspect in that the hospital... its mission is, you know, very pro-life, supposedly.
All right.
Anyway, at least that's articulated. And there'd be a kind of responsibility to that mission that we would hope would help overcome whatever challenges are thrown their way to accept this patient. So that was the number, that moved to the top of my private secret list of hospitals.
Okay.
And we had several, there were several teams that were reporting to me that were there, I guess, kind of at least three teams that were searching most actively for a hospital and corresponding with them.
All right.
That were doing it, you know, officially through the family.
All right.
And they were being coordinated by myself, these teams, but I had my own secret list.
Okay.
Because I didn't know everybody on the other teams and hadn't worked with some of them before. So I kept my ace hospital kind of secret. And so learned what we can from the others. And then when the time came, we used that ace. And it was done quietly and quickly. And it was done outside of the knowledge of even the other teams.
Okay.
So
you had to protect yourself even from inside leaks.
Exactly. Well, not just inside leaks, but I didn't know what everyone's motivations were. I had already had some negative experiences with some people I had allowed to come into the network on a provisional basis.
All right.
So I didn't know for sure what I was dealing with. And because the failures were coming in left, right, and center with the hospitals being, deceived into or otherwise, choosing not to except Baby Joseph. It wasn't necessarily always for the deception, but there were also public relations reasons that there were people concerned that this could blow up in their faces, you know, as a public relations nightmare for themselves, that they could become the next targeted hospital for a public scrutiny and criticism. So there were other factors, but that was, I know enough of the other side of it that we know they were being deceived and that was affecting decisions.
Okay.
I have that right from very reliable levels in some U.S., you know, hospital setting situations.
Shall we go on next time with your experience of the hospitals, name them, and how you were blocked in, with several of them, and then get back to this question of the press being silenced, which is very disturbing.
Sure. Actually, you asked that, and I didn't even answer it. I'm sorry. So if you want, we could save it for next time, or I could describe it now if you want.
Where does it fit in?
It fits in when I was describing how I had made a decision to involve the pro-lifers making a press conference in London.
Oh, okay.
Early on.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So this is one example. For that press conference, a number of media people showed up at the event.
Mm-hmm.
And there was almost nothing in the way of coverage that actually reached the public. And I can tell you that one of the people who was assisting us was at the, well, several, but one of them was in the audience of reporters, one of the people who was assisting us. And they overheard a cell phone call that happened just behind them,
right.
The reporter, who picked up their phone when it rang. And the reporter said hello, and then there was a pause, and then the reporter said, "What do you mean I can't run the story?"
Oh no.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was one example. I'll give you another example. The U.S. media is where we went to in order to allow this to be heard by enough people in the public, because it was clear that the Canadian media was being shut down through some networking effort.
Mm-hmm.
That was obviously emanating from the hospital, or the Ministry of Health, rather. They're all connected, and you know they hobnob with each other in high society. And
mm-hmm.
people who run media are not unfamiliar to people on the board of the Hospital for Sick Children.
Okay.
So it's not a difficult matter when you have those kinds of connections to make some phone calls or have some discussions and convince people in positions of power in the media to either squelch or, you know, completely avoid the story. And this was happening in Canada remarkably well. It was rampantly being discussed in the media in the U.S. So it was a real, almost humorous differential. It's a Canadian story, and yet the U.S. is where it was mostly being discussed in the media nationally in
yeah,
the U.S.
I appreciate
that. We had interviews from major networks like CNN, Fox, and all the while the Canadian media was being quite silent or almost silent or just not loud enough about it compared to the U.S.
Okay.
And I'm not just talking about Fox. I'm talking other networks as well. We're picking
okay.
up the story in the U.S.
All right.
So it wasn't just a Republican agenda countering Obama's health care political issues. There was interest beyond that.
Okay.
And so we came to rely on the U.S., and part of the way that those interviews were being conducted is through, is it Waterloo, where there's a university near London?
Yeah.
Wherever the nearby university is.
Western and Waterloo.
It might have been Western now. I can't remember which of the two universities, but one of them has a satellite facility.
Right.
Satellite communication facility. And that's where we were having the interviews conducted.
Okay.
So we went through, I think, two of them with some major U.S. network. And then by the time the third interview was being set up a few days later, the network in the U.S. was told that that facility was not available, and it was available only for university purposes.
I see.
So all of a sudden, they even found a way to try to tamper with the U.S. coverage. So we ended up having to get a driver, or the network paid for a driver, to drive the family members from London to Toronto. so they can use another satellite location.
Okay.
In Toronto.
All right.
So those are two examples. I don't know if that's enough, but that should be pretty suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, that the U.S., I'm sorry, the Canadian media was being, I would say, silenced somewhat on pursuing this story. And there was also interference that affected the convenience or efficiency of being able to conduct U.S. interviews as well when that university of whatever it was, Western Ontario and Waterloo, when that when they shut down our access to use their satellite for news transmissions.
And now Jimmy Thackeray, hang up and drive. Listening to Sam Sansalone talk about the inside scoop on the Baby Joseph story, the many ways there are to kill a helpless disabled infant. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.